A truly decentralized and permissionless payment network requires its own underlying self-custodial digital bearer asset. If instead it runs on top of the fiat currency system, or relies on external custodial arrangements at its foundation, then it is neither decentralized nor permissionless. Hello, hello, welcome back to Ethereum Audible. Happy Tuesday. Hope the week is going great. Welcome back to your weekly piece of in-depth Web3 reading, listening, easy listening. It's kind of like a classical music station, but only about Web3 and crypto. Today, I'm going to be doing something a little bit different. We're going to be breaking off from the different reads that we've been doing on consensus protocols and proof of stake. Not because proof of stake isn't important, not because the ETH merge isn't coming, just because A, it's good to change things up and get a little change of pace, but B, because Lynn Alden, one of my favorite writers in the crypto and macro space, just put out a piece on Bitcoin's Lightning Network. It's called A Look at the Lightning Network, Examining the Scaling Method of the Bitcoin Network and its Evolution from a Store of Value to a Medium of Exchange, and the reason that I want to read this in our Ethereum Audible podcast. I mean, Bitcoin, Lightning, Ethereum, what do they have to do with each other? Well, they have a lot to do with each other. And the reason I want to read them is, A, I've been going down the research hole, the rabbit hole of what Bitcoin's maximum store of value can be based on its future transaction history. As we know, Bitcoin's halving schedule is approaching 2024. There's supposed to be another halving event. And then basically, by most forecasts, by 2028, the next halving, the block rewards won't be enough to secure the network, at least not based on the current market cap for Bitcoin. So this is a topic that's really interesting to me. I think that's number one, and I've written a piece on it called the Bitcoin Maxi Price, What's the Maximum Price for Bitcoin?, which you can find on my website called The Wizard's Tower. And second of all, this is just interesting because a lot of use cases in micropayments are being put into place on the Lightning Network and not in the Ethereum ecosystem. If you have downloaded the Fountain app, which is a podcast app, you can listen to podcasts and stream sats, which is a really cool use case for a new kind of business model for content. Right? Instead of advertising, instead of subscriptions, it's pay-per-use. And that's possible using Lightning on top of Bitcoin. So in the Web3 world, I think Lightning is really, really interesting and is being built out in a pretty cool way. And it has a lot of use cases. So that's why I think this is worthy to look at also in a broader Web3 ecosystem. And also just because I enjoy reading Lynn Alden's work, and this is an hour and a half of reading time. So you're probably not going to read this on your own, which is why it's perfect for audio. So that's what we're going to be reading today. And this is probably going to be a two-parter just because it's an hour and a half long. And as always, I want to give a shout out to Alp Audio, A-L-P-E Audio. If you want to learn and master topics in depth from A to Z, but you don't have the time to do it, Alp Audio is the place for you to try out and check out those courses, because it's audio courses built for memory retention and learning mastery. So you can find the link in the podcast notes for Alp Audio. And without further ado, let's dive into A Look at the Lightning Network, Examining the Scaling Method of the Bitcoin Network and Its Evolution from a Store of Value to a Medium of Exchange by Lynn Alden. This article examines the relationship between a monetary asset being a store of value versus being a medium of exchange. Specifically, it focuses on the scaling method of the Bitcoin network as its main example, but also takes a broad look at the history of trade-offs in the cryptocurrency space, as well to see why a layered approach makes the most sense. The primary goal of this article is to examine the topic of how Bitcoin has evolved as a medium of exchange, and more broadly, to analyze the order in which new monetary assets can be accepted as a store of value and a medium of exchange. As a big part of that, I'll include an analysis of the Lightning Network, which is a small but fast-growing payments layer that is interwoven into the Bitcoin network. And here there is a chart from Arcane Research showing that the payment volume and payment count on the Lightning Network has had a compound annual growth rate of 410% since Q1 of 2021 and Q1 of 2022. It peaked in Q4 of 2021 and since then dropped by about 50%, but the CAGR is still 410%. Summary points. This article is long, so I'll summarize the main points up front here, and then spend the rest of the article diving into the details. 1. A truly decentralized and permissionless payment network requires its own underlying self-custodial digital bearer asset. If instead it runs on top of the fiat currency system, or relies on external custodial arrangements at its foundation, then it is neither decentralized nor permissionless. 2. In order to create a truly new digital bearer asset that is useful for payments in the long run, it must also be an attractive store of value, so that a meaningful percentage of the population begins to persistently hold it as some percentage of their liquid net worth and be willing to accept it for goods and services. 3. In other words, in order to create a decentralized version of Visa, beneath that you must first create a decentralized version of Fedwire, and along with that, you must first create a decentralized version of digital gold. It's hard to envision any other path succeeding. 4. Bitcoin started with a smart design from the beginning. It created an underlying digital gold and settlement network with a credible degree of decentralization, auditability, scarcity, and immutability that no other network currently rivals. On top of that foundation, Lightning as a payment network is being developed and has reached a critical mass of liquidity and usability. 5. Many cryptocurrencies that followed in Bitcoin's wake put the cart before the horse. They optimized for throughput and speed on their base layer at the cost of weaker decentralization, auditability, scarcity, and/or immutability of the underlying bearer asset. As such, they fail to gain structural adoption as money and render their high throughput irrelevant, especially since they were brought into exist in the shadow of Bitcoin's larger network effect. 6. Volatility is inevitable along the path of monetization. A new money cannot go from zero to trillions without upward volatility by definition, and with upward volatility comes speculators, leverage, and periods of downward volatility. The first couple of decades of monetization for the network as it undergoes open price discovery to reach the bulk of its total addressable market should be different than the steady state of the network after it reaches the bulk of its total addressable market, assuming it is successful in doing so. 7. Taxes on cryptocurrency transactions, as well as the lower supply inflation rate of bitcoins compared to fiat currencies, results in Gresham's Law being applicable here. Most people in developed countries have an incentive to spend their fiat and hoard their Bitcoin like an investment, at least in this stage of the monetization process. The exception is for the subset of people who specifically need Bitcoin or Lightning's permissionless nature for one reason or another, or for whom the majority of their liquid net worth is in it. 8. People in developing countries, with higher inflation and weaker payment and banking systems in general, have more of a natural incentive to use Lightning as a medium of exchange earlier on in its monetization process. Indeed, adoption rates are rather promising in many of those regions. This isn't surprising, considering that more people in developing countries have smartphones than bank accounts, in aggregate. 9. An overview of how the Lightning Network works in a basic sense, and why channel-based transaction systems make more sense than broadcast transaction systems for individual payments. 10. A look at other use cases for the Lightning Network, including its usage as a fast settlement system to move dollars and other fiat currencies around globally, through the core Bitcoin liquidity of the network. 11. A response to various criticisms of the Lightning Network, including an explanation of why comparing its small size to various larger DeFi projects is a category error, and an analysis of its scaling potential. And 12. Concluding thoughts on the regulatory and enforcement hurdles governments face now that open-source peer-to-peer payments technology exists. So that is everything that this article covers, and we will dive into the first topic, store of value versus medium of exchange. Humans in tiny groups don't need money. They can organize resources among themselves manually. However, groups that reach the Dunbar number, or larger, usually start identifying and making use of some form of money, which gives them a more liquid, divisible, friction-minimized, and widely accepted accounting unit for storing and exchanging value with people they don't know. What makes good money? And how does a new money get adopted by users? I catalog the history of this question from multiple points of view in my article, What is Money Anyway? The short answer, from thousands of years of history across multiple continents, is that commodity money that is adopted organically needs to have a reasonably high stock-to-flow ratio and needs sufficient divisibility, portability, durability, fungibility, and verifiability while being desirable to hold for some reason. When different commodity monies come in contact with each other, often due to contact between cultures with varying levels of technology, the money that is harder to produce, as in able to maintain a persistently higher stock-to-flow ratio, even in the face of improving human technology, wins out. Money in a society generally consolidates towards one or two, rather than many of them coexisting together indefinitely. Precious metals, and specifically gold, won the commodity money competition over thousands of years. Ledger-only systems, referring to paper and bank currency systems with flexible money supplies that are backed by nothing and have no cost to produce, have been tried a number of times in history. Each of those fiat currencies inevitably failed over a longer enough timeline. The temptation by central policymakers to produce more, especially in times of crisis, is always there. To assume that such a system can last forever, without a breakdown or reset of some sort, is to assume that there will be an unbroken chain of competent and selfless centralized operators of that money system. However, with the development of telecommunications technology and global bank ledgers, fiat currencies eventually offered an actual improvement in long-range transaction and verification speeds compared to precious metals, which, along with the taxation, or sometimes outright banning of precious metals and other monies, is part of what led to their widespread adoption for the first time in history. Precious metals as bearer assets were not divisible or portable enough to keep up with global commerce at the speed of telecommunication channels, and thus had to be abstracted with pegs, claims, and counterparty risks. Due to this speed mismatch and subsequent abstraction, policymakers managed to drop precious metals away from the process altogether, other than keeping them as opaque sovereign reserves, and were able to create a ledger-only system around the entire world that is currently in its sixth decade of operation. The dollar has a lower stock-to-flow ratio than gold, but does have a higher average stock-to-flow ratio than most other commodities, and has the property that it can be sent around the world relatively quickly, while most of its scarcer competition, like gold, is both slow and taxed. The dollar is not something you particularly want to store value in for decades, but it clearly has its use cases in terms of payments and near-term savings due to how the global financial system has been engineered. I do, however, think that this fiat system that has been in place since the 1970s is becoming more unstable over time, and will end up undergoing some type of longer-run devaluation and realignment to clear excess debt out of the system. That process has already been in place for over a decade in the US, and I expect it to continue both here and elsewhere in the world. And when we look globally, there are dozens of countries with current or recent inflation rates over 25%, and or that have had currency resets or hyperinflations within our lifetimes. The Bitcoin network introduces payment and settlement speeds that are faster than fiat currencies, but its units also have a higher stock-to-flow ratio than gold, and can be used self-custodially and peer-to-peer through the decentralized network. However, it's new and volatile, poorly understood, and certainly not without risk. And so Bitcoins often get criticized for being too volatile to be used as a medium of exchange. And outside of niche circumstances, Bitcoins are indeed only slightly used as medium of exchange in their current early stage of monetization. Blockchain trade-offs. A number of cryptocurrencies market themselves as faster competitors to the Bitcoin network, and thus supposedly better suited as a medium of exchange. Putting aside smart contract platforms and proof-of-stake coins for the moment, we can do a cursory look through some of the notable proof-of-work monies that have sprung up in the wake of the Bitcoin network. I think it's natural for the market to explore multiple wrong answers to see in practice what the right answers are. And part of what allows me to analyze these concepts is the historical track record of why and how various projects fail to accrue value. Litecoin was invented in 2011 based on the design of Bitcoin, but with a few changes regarding how it is mined and how long its block times are, and marketed as silver to Bitcoin's gold. Specifically, it uses faster 2.5-minute block times compared to Bitcoin's 10-minute block times. It hit big highs in 2013, and then hit much bigger highs in 2017, at which point the creator sold his position at the top of the market. In 2021, during the altcoin season, Litecoin managed to roughly match those 2017 highs, but wasn't able to gain traction to go up multiples from those highs. After a very long stretch of being in the top 10 coins by market capitalization, it's starting to stagnate and fall down the market cap rankings of cryptocurrencies, and is no longer in the top 10. As one of the oldest coins that continues to operate as designed, Litecoin's price chart denominated in Bitcoin is a quintessential example of how most coins persistently degrade over time in Bitcoin-denominated terms after experiencing their initial spike. And here there is a chart that shows Litecoin's journey from its high of a 0.04 of Bitcoin's market cap all the way to 0.005. So traveling down all the way. Dogecoin, created as a joke in 2013 based on the design of Litecoin, managed to hit notably higher highs in 2017, and then had a massive meme spike in 2021 thanks to pumping by Elon Musk, followed by a 90%+ crash. It is 1 minute block times and no supply cap. Numerous other dog-themed coins have come along in its wake, each having a brief spike before crashing. These are joke coins that nonetheless tricked a lot of retail investors into buying them at the top. A number of crypto exchanges unfortunately marketed them aggressively to retail investors right at the top in order to make a quick buck, and therefore contributed to a bubble that sucked a lot of people in for a major capital loss. Monero, created in 2014 as a privacy-themed coin, has been unable to decisively surpass its 2017 highs, and has fallen very deep in the cryptocurrency market capitalization rankings. Monero uses some interesting privacy mechanisms, but relies on indirect proofs to audit the supply, which means there's a non-zero chance of there being an undetected inflation bug at any given time. Monero has 2-minute block times, and the way it's designed does not currently allow for a lightning-like payment channel network to exist on top of it. I would like to see more privacy development within the Bitcoin ecosystem to make privacy techniques more automatic and easier to use. Bitcoin's hard forks like Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin Satoshi Vision have fared worse. Some went away, while others such as these two survive in a weakened state. What they have in common is that they increased block size so that more transactions can be packaged to each block. Both of them have gone down significantly in Bitcoin-denominated terms. Bitcoin Cash, which was forked from the primary Bitcoin network in 2017, hasn't yet been able to touch its 2017 highs in dollar terms. Bitcoin Satoshi Vision, forked from Bitcoin Cash in 2018, has been in a choppy sideways pattern since inception, is currently below the price that it split at, and has been the subject of 51% attacks due to its low hash rate. If about 1% of Bitcoin miners want to do a 51% attack on either of these chains, they can do so, since Bitcoin's hash rate is orders of magnitude higher, and they all share the same hashing algorithm. The main problem of having faster block times and or larger block sizes is that if the network is heavily used, the bandwidth and storage requirements for running a full node become rather high, which makes it hard for the typical user to run a full node to audit the network. And by extension, that makes the rules of the network less credibly immutable since the number of full nodes is tiny. Going too fast can also create a problem with stability. When we look at the adoption pattern of the Bitcoin network and some of its failed forks and competitors, we can quickly see a basic problem that many of these forks and competitors encountered and why they failed. They tried to make a broad medium of exchange out of something that was not a store of value, and without the government power of fiat. And this was in addition to the fact that they had the big problem of existing in the shadow of Bitcoin's far more dominant network effect. They even went so far as to sacrifice their decentralization and immutability and auditability, which is a big piece of what could potentially make something like Bitcoin a store of value, in order to advance their goal of being a medium exchange. This path, however, leads to failure and irrelevance. In other words, in order to invent a successful, decentralized, peer-to-peer Visa-type network, as in a fast transaction layer, one must first invent an underlying decentralized, peer-to-peer Fedwire-type network, which is a settlement layer, along with a reason why the underlying unit should be held for the long term compared to other assets, as in digital gold. The long road to monetization. Fascinating thing about watching the Cambrian explosion of new private monies or cryptocurrencies since 2009 based on Satoshi Nakamoto's creation of the Bitcoin network is that it represents a new test for economic theories on the topic of what makes good money versus what does not. Everybody has a theory on what makes some monies better than others, but in the long arc of time, it's the market that decides. Even for government-controlled currencies, the international market decides between them. Any cryptocurrency can have success in the intermediate term, but the real test is which ones, if any, can stick around and gain structural adoption over the course of many years and decades through bull markets and bear markets alike. So far, the Bitcoin network has gone through four huge bull and bear cycles, 2011, 2013, 2017, and 2021, while gaining value and users in an exponentially compounding way. Each bull cycle reached a level of scale that was significantly larger than the prior bull cycle, in terms of market capitalization and the number of users. Now it is legal tender in a few regions of the world, and a number of large institutions hold it on their balance sheets in various ways. Simple bubbles don't survive through several 70%+ drawdowns over a period lasting 13 years and counting. It looks more like Metcalfe's law of network adoption at this point. That doesn't mean it is without risks, but it means it should be studied and understood rather than dismissed to see what it is about this network that allows it to keep growing through resistance. And most notably, Bitcoin did this without any central organization promoting it. The inventor disappeared by 2011, and then even his follow-up lead developer and a number of other early developers left in the ensuing years as part of various technical disputes involving the block size. It has been a rather decentralized, open-source, self-sustaining network of rolling participation ever. Out of the other thousands of cryptocurrencies, the vast majority failed to successfully get through one cycle. They have a big bubble spike during bull market and then crash and then never recover those bubble highs again. Founders, insiders, and others who bought super early can have spectacular gains on the back of investors who came in late, but their coins don't lead to structural adoption and growth. Only a small handful of them have made it through two or three cycles of higher dollar-denominated network value. Store of value precedes mass medium of exchange. For the Bitcoin network, usage as a niche censorship-resistant medium of exchange came first, followed by it being used as a broader store of value, which became a much larger use case. From there, the more it is used as a store of value and the better its scaling solutions become, the more it can be widely used as a mass medium of exchange. Let's consider adoption patterns. Suppose you owned some Bitcoins and other cryptos sometime in the 2011 to 2017 range, when all of those various blockchain monies and forks were in the heat of their competition against the Bitcoin network as a medium of exchange, and being marketed as such. Before the launch of the Lightning Network, if you were a person with easy access to banking and payment services and were not deplatformed from anything in particular, why would you spend Bitcoins on anything? If the number of dollars keeps increasing every year, but Bitcoins have a hard supply cap at 21 million coins, why would you want to give your Bitcoins to others? Unless you've been holding Bitcoin so long that it has become a meaningful share of your net worth, or you actively work in the industry and potentially even get paid in Bitcoin, you probably wouldn't. This problem is then magnified by the fact that Bitcoins have 10-minute average confirmation times. Bitcoin Cash coins have 10-minute average confirmation times, and even Litecoins and Dogecoins, which are meant to be faster, have 2.5-minute and 1-minute average confirmation times respectively, which is still too slow for convenient in-person transactions. The process is longer if you want to wait for a number of confirmation times to reduce the probability that the transaction will be reversed. These are crappy things to buy coffee with in that form. It's like trying to buy coffee with a wire transfer. No thanks. That's what MasterCard is for. There are circumstances where the Bitcoin's network base layer payment options are ideal as a medium of exchange, but to try to force it into a situation where it's not ideal doesn't make sense. As I described in my What is Money Anyway article, Bitcoin base layer payments are tank-like censorship-resistant payments. Owning Bitcoin represents the stored-up ability to make censorship-resistant global payments in the future, and or to the portably bring wealth around the world even by just memorizing 12 words, or holding a private key somewhere on your physical person or in your digital files. This transaction problem is then further compounded by the fact that every cryptocurrency transaction is a taxable event. Governments don't want other monies to compete with theirs if they can help it, and so they view your bitcoins as commodities, and if you exchange them for something, you've now locked in a capital gain that is taxable. Assuming you don't want to break tax laws, you technically need to keep track of every Bitcoin transaction that you do for tax season. Furthermore, the number of people that have any meaningful amount of their net worth in Bitcoin or other coins remains very low. What is the immediate incentive for a merchant to accept Bitcoin or other coins, unless they happen to serve a niche industry where the percentage of Bitcoin or crypto users in their customer base is higher than normal? I've described this merchant acceptance problem in prior research when talking about the credit card oligopoly. There are four meaningful card networks in the US, which also extend globally: Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover. These have been around for decades. Merchants accept them as payment because that's what all of their customers have in their wallets. Customers have them in their wallets because merchants widely accept them. These networks' flywheels were bootstrapped decades ago. It would be nearly impossible to create a fifth credit card in the US. You'd have to convince merchants to accept it despite users not yet having it, and you'd have to convince users to get one even though merchants don't accept it yet. It's really hard to bootstrap from nothing and compete with existing network effects. Bitcoins and various cryptocurrencies encountered the same problem. Some places accepted them as a novelty, and some people wanted to spend them here or there. But for the most part, the topic of cryptocurrencies as everyday payments was a dud during that whole 2011 to 2017 era, just like trying to launch a fifth credit card would be, except slower and more taxable. The primary use of Bitcoin for medium of exchange purposes in those early years were people who were deplatformed in various ways. Cypherpunks were naturally attracted to Bitcoin's censorship-resistant payments, WikiLeaks turned to accepting Bitcoins when they were deplatformed from PayPal in 2010, a subset of early users bought drugs on the internet with Bitcoins until those centralized marketplaces were shut down. Human rights advocates began using Bitcoin in authoritarian regimes with low banking access or vulnerability to arbitrary bank freezes. These use cases weren't for efficiency, they were for peer-to-peer censorship resistance. For mass medium of exchange usage, meaning far beyond niche censorship-resistant use cases, a new money likely needs to become a store of value first, if it is to arise organically rather than through government decree. And the payment experience needs to compete with various near-instant fiat payment methods. A lot of people need to each have a lot of the money, and then start asking merchants, "Why didn't you accept this yet?" As it gets big enough, or becomes perceived as offering better payment solutions than legacy systems, a number of jurisdictions can even remove the per-transaction tax on it. Where most cryptocurrencies went wrong. Since store-of-value usage precedes mass medium of exchange usage, the fatal flaw of Litecoin, Dogecoin, Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin Satoshi Vision, and most of these types of attempts at medium of exchange cryptocurrencies is that they put the cart before the horse. As previously described, these types of projects wanted to sacrifice some degree of stability, or decentralization, or immutability, or auditability, in order to optimize themselves as higher throughput media of exchange, even though hardly anyone was using them as a store of value yet, with negligible adoption. They were basically just building fintech payment companies with tiny teams of people, and expecting to compete with Visa, despite having way worse user experience, way slower speeds, and way less transaction throughput. And yet, if we steelman their position, it's somewhat understandable why some of them tried to do that. Satoshi Nakamoto described his original design as a peer-to-peer e-cash system, and what exactly cash is can have a few different meanings. In 2010, Satoshi briefly wrote about how the network could gradually scale in terms of block size over time, even though he was also the one who put the block size limit into the code. After he left, however, some people wanted to scale too much and too early, and without broad consensus to do such a contentious hard fork. By jamming hard forks through and going in their own direction away from the Bitcoin network, users of these other protocols had to go through the difficult experience of seeing how powerful the widely distributed network of node users had become, and how pushing unwanted updates to them is impossible. I think too many people in those early years interpreted eCash to mean quick and easy payments for everyday goods using the base layer, when a better way to think of cash today is as a private censorship-resistant final settlement transaction method. Physical cash, after all, is not necessarily the easiest payment type or a medium of exchange that we need to use for everything, but it's the most private and the hardest to prevent from occurring. Therefore, when we think of eCash, we likely shouldn't think of it as optimizing for speed and efficiency right on the base layer for every transaction that we do, but rather, we should think of it as optimizing for those same things that physical cash is great for: private and censorship-resistant final settlement payments that can be used when it makes sense to do so. Plus, Bitcoin was already well optimized for early adopters that actually wanted to use it as a private medium of exchange online at the time. Some of them viewed privacy as a fundamental human right, and were aware of oppressive regimes where this type of technology could be useful to protect people. Others were dealing with real-world constraints of other means of payment, such as Roya Mahbub, who used it to pay women and girls in Afghanistan, where access to bank accounts by females is more restricted. Bitcoin was also used very early by people using online black markets, as well, in a similar way that criminals were early adopters of pagers as a technology, which doesn't make the technology itself bad. There were various niches of people where Bitcoin was indeed an ideal medium of exchange from the beginning, and Bitcoin scaled well enough for those niches. Satoshi picked his variables very carefully to ensure that cypherpunks like him had a working anonymous censorship-resistant peer-to-peer medium of exchange online to start with. So it was and still is a very useful eCash. These types of people could and would wait 30 minutes for an online transaction to process with a few confirmations. They could and would run their own node. They could and would use private techniques to acquire and dispose of their coins. This was a utility network with a mild monetary premium. It offered money that a relatively small group of people at the time would desire to use, and was recognized for its value by users and speculators. Like almost every commodity that gets adopted as money, it had utility first and gained a monetary premium second as a result of that utility. The utility was that it provided access to a tank-like medium of exchange network that could exchange value globally without centralized intermediaries to stop it, and with a better combination of monetary immutability, censorship resistance, and liquidity than the countless imitators that followed in its wake. After enough time had passed, this fluctuating monetary premium of Bitcoin's price attracted speculators and investors that had no intention of using it for a medium of exchange anytime soon, similar to why many people buy gold. A subset of Austrian economists, for example, began recognizing Bitcoins as being interesting monetary goods. Specifically, the finitude of the coin supply at 21 million stood out to some of them. When it became more broadly understood how immutable the Bitcoin's network rule set was, and how its security and liquidity and decentralization dwarfed any other proof-of-work cryptocurrencies, many people began considering it to be hard money. A number of human rights activists began to recognize it as an ideal anti-authoritarian technology for its censorship-resistant aspects and using it as such. The mistake of the Litecoin bulls and the Bitcoin Cash bulls and so forth was that they wanted to scale too early to a bigger group of people before there was a market for it, and even at the cost of weaker decentralization. Bitcoin's base layer is enough for tens of millions of people to use it on an occasional basis, for when its specific properties are ideal. The Bitcoin network on the base layer is like the 60-ton armor tank of payments and saving systems, holding and transferring value globally in a censorship-resistant manner. A tank is ideal if you need to get from point A to point B through hostile terrain, and blast through anything in your path. It's not ideal for commuting to work in. Trying to force base layer Bitcoin transactions to be used as a daily of medium of exchange by the general public is like trying to make commuting in tanks to catch on. It's not going to, because that's not what it's designed for. And to try to make it scale to everyone for all payments on that base layer makes it lose most of the properties that make it useful for what it does best. It would take over a terabyte of data storage per day to create a base layer system capable of supporting tens of thousands of transactions per second. The earliest analysis of the Bitcoin network by Hal Finney and others predicted that the network would likely evolve towards a layered approach. Bitcoin versus dollar examples. There are over 100 million people in the world who are estimated to own Bitcoin as of this past year. That's 1 to 2% of global population, depending on the exact number. Since the number is reliant on exchange data, surveys, and other opaque assessments, in some countries, however, the adoption percentage seems to be in the low double digits. However, most of that is pretty shallow. We can quantify adoption by both breadth and depth. Breadth would refer to how many people have a non-zero amount of Bitcoin. Depth would refer to how much of their liquid money they have in Bitcoin. What I mean by this example is that someone having $264 worth of Bitcoin sitting in a semi-dormant crypto exchange account is not adopting Bitcoin to any economically significant degree. As a thought experiment, imagine a world where people hold Bitcoins and/or dollars as liquid money. And furthermore, let's assume, bear with me, that Bitcoin continues to increase in dollar price over the long run, albeit with plenty of volatility along the way, as a result of Bitcoin's much lower rate of new unit creation compared to the rate of new dollar creation, and more people learning about Bitcoin and wanting to hold a non-zero amount of it. So if someone buys a Bitcoin, then even without further purchases, it will probably become a somewhat bigger share of their liquid money over many years, if this thesis is correct. Now, suppose that only 1% of people own Bitcoin. 99% do not. And suppose that those that do own Bitcoin, they have just 3% of their liquid money in it on average. Total Bitcoin adoption is therefore 0.03% compared to 99.97% cash in that system. Bitcoin adoption in that context is negligible. There's little reason for merchants to accept it other than out of novelty or if they specifically cater to cypherpunks. If 10% of people own Bitcoin and have an average of 5% of their liquid money in it, then that is 0.5% total adoption compared to 99.5% cash. Still a rounding error, but nonetheless a niche market with millions of people. If 30% of people own Bitcoin and have 10% of their liquid money in it, then that is 3% total adoption compared to 97% cash. That's a vocal minority representing a lot of niche purchasing power. If 50% of people own Bitcoin and have 20% of their liquid money in it, then that is 10% of total adoption compared to 90% cash. That is a huge market. If 70% of people own Bitcoin and have 30% of their liquid money in it, then that is a 21% of total adoption compared to 79% cash. That's enormous. In order for many people to want to spend Bitcoin, it's more likely that they would have bought some long ago and perhaps kept buying, took the time to learn how to custody it themselves rather than hold it on an exchange, and after years of price appreciation, it's a decent chunk of their liquid monetary value. They either want to sell some for cash to buy something, or even easier, just buy something with it directly. Of course, in reality, it's bumpier than that. Some early adopters in this scenario will reach very high levels of their net worth in Bitcoin, and they become a wealthy cohort to cater to by niche merchants early on. So mass merchant adoption might take a while, but of course, there would be early merchants that want to cater to that early group, or that sell products that many Bitcoin holders would specifically want to buy. Think of developing countries first. If the numbers in the example above seem extreme, how could Bitcoin possibly reach 20%+ share of the dollar market, then rerun them for a developing country instead. Replace the US with Nigeria and the dollar with a Naira in the above example. Nigeria has among the highest Bitcoin adoption levels in the world, despite the fact that their government has cut off the fiat bank on-ramps to Bitcoin and crypto exchanges to try to protect the Naira. When a currency looks like this, people can and will try to find others to use, even through resistance. And this is a picture of the Nigeria M2 money supply, where it's grown from 10 billion in 2008 to 50 billion today. Developing countries with higher average inflation and weaker payment systems are where Bitcoins via the Lightning Network can actually scale quickly as a medium of exchange, because for many of them, it could indeed solve an everyday payments problem pretty early on in its monetization process. That's why there is often a huge mismatch in perceptions about Bitcoin between privileged commentators and actual users. To the extent that the Bitcoin network continues monetizing and growing, it's not because it eats the US dollar or the Swiss franc first. It's eating periphery currencies with high inflation, weak property rights, and bad payment systems first, and then it moves inward from there. Bitcoin is already bigger than the broad money supply of any developing countries, and is accepted in more points around the world than many developing country currencies, which are generally only accepted within their issuing country or at a small number of specific exchange points internationally. Bitcoin merchants' acceptance doesn't have the density of any specific currency within that currency's issuing country, of course, but it has a wider international reach than most currencies. The bigger the Bitcoin network gets, and over a longer period of time, the more rational it becomes for merchants to accept it. The more merchants that accept it, the stronger the network becomes, because then Bitcoins don't need to be converted back into fiat currency on one of a handful of centralized bank-connected exchanges for people that want to make use of them. In this sense, wide merchant acceptance is a form of censorship resistance. When thinking about this, think of merchants in developing countries more so than just merchants in developed countries. And over time, a number of companies have been created that allow a merchant to easily accept it, and then either hold Bitcoins or exchange them for fiat currency immediately, so they don't deal with the Bitcoins directly. The technical friction for accepting Bitcoins as payment keeps decreasing. The lesson of Gresham's Law. Gresham's Law is the principle that bad money drives out good. If people have a good money and a bad money, they would rather spend the bad money and keep the good money. Ironically, then, the bad money is what tends to circulate with high velocity while the good money is hoarded with low velocity. This trend revealed itself multiple times under bimetallic standards, when gold and silver were fixed relative to each other by government decree, but this fix was slightly off the global supply-demand ratio balance, which would change over time. Then one of the metals would start to disappear from circulation. For example, quote, "The United States began with a bimetallic standard in which the dollar was defined in terms of both gold or silver at weights and fineness such that gold and silver were set in value to each other at a ratio of 15 to 1. Because world markets value them at a 15.5 to 1 ratio, much of the gold left the country, and silver was the de facto standard. In 1834, the gold content of the dollar was reduced to make the ratio 16 to 1. As a result, silver left the country and gold became the de facto standard." End quote, from A Brief History of the Gold Standard in the US. There are a couple of processes for how that happens. The first process is simply that the better and undervalued money gets hoarded, and so it stays in the country but gets removed from everyday circulation. People will not usually part with what they perceive as being undervalued. The second process is that international entities can observe this and arbitrage it. For example, if the global ratio of gold to silver is 15.5 to 1, but Americans have it fixed by the government decree at 15 to 1, which is slightly undervaluing gold versus silver, then a European entity can keep selling silver to the Americans and buying gold from the Americans. As years or decades pass, there will be a lot less gold in the United States and a significant amount of silver instead. The US broad money supply has grown at more than a 7% annualized rate since 1970. Most developed countries have a similar rate to that, and emerging markets tend to have a much higher rate on average. Meanwhile, the Bitcoin supply is growing at less than 1.8% per year, which will fall to below 0.9% in a couple of years, and to around 0.4% 4 years after that. The Bitcoin network is programmed to asymptotically approach 21 million Bitcoins in total by having its supply inflation rate every 4 years until it has 0% supply inflation. And unlike most other blockchain monies, the wide node network helps ensure that no centralizing force can change this distribution pattern, and it has the dominant network effect among proof-of-work blockchain monies, which makes it more protected against 51% censorship or transaction reversal attacks. It's natural for people to want to hoard something like gold or Bitcoin, and spend their dollars, pounds, yen, euros, yuan, pesos, naira, and rupees. Money that depreciates in value tends to circulate, while scarce money that tends to appreciate in value gets hoarded, with much lower spending velocity. This becomes especially true if a jurisdiction treats the harder money like property and taxes each transaction, which most jurisdictions do. If you try to use things like gold or bitcoins as media of exchange, each transaction is a taxable event compared to your initial cost basis when you originally bought that asset. The incentive, therefore, is to hoard the taxable gold or the taxable Bitcoin, with their lower levels of supply inflation, and spend the non-taxable fiat currency on consumption unless someone has a strong desire for Bitcoin's censorship-resistant payment properties. For example, Bitcoins have been used as a medium of exchange by girls in Afghanistan, by Russian political opposition when their bank accounts get frozen, by Nigerian merchants and protesters, by people getting capital out of China, by people getting their money out of Venezuela, Iran, Palestine, and elsewhere, by underbanked people in El Salvador, and more. It's also used in developed markets for some natively online services, such as Substack or buying VPNs, and many others. And yes, in the early years, for people to buy drugs online and occasionally for things like ransomware attacks. I've met a number of these human rights advocates in person. One of the most powerful moments was hearing Ire Aderinokun, co-founder of Nigeria's feminist coalition, speak in Norway's parliament building earlier this year about how when they protested police violence in Nigeria, they had their bank accounts frozen and resorted to using bitcoins instead, for their self-custodial and censorship-resistant properties. I was familiar with that story from the news, but it's always more interesting and clear to hear first-hand accounts of it from them in person. In this sense, although Gresham's law originally applied to fixed exchange rates, I think it applies more broadly anytime there is transactional friction of some sort, including a tax. The weaker, lower friction currency will be spent first, unless there is a strong practical reason to do otherwise, meaning a use case that specifically needs Bitcoin's unique properties. So, a self-custodied store of value and payment system like the Bitcoin network is great for many people, but its exact usage pattern depends on context. It'll tend to be adopted as a medium of exchange by people who need it a lot more quickly than people who don't really need it. And I think this is where I'm going to call it a day for part one of this read-through. And next week, we're going to continue reading through the continuation of this piece, and we're going to cover the volatile process of monetization. We're going to cover Bitcoin and Lightning, basically how you scale in layers, a primer on the Lightning network, and then the adoption of the Lightning network. So I want to recap the first section of Lynn Alden's piece on the Lightning network, because part two will build on it, but it's good to cement it in our minds. The main case here, the main thesis, is that a medium of exchange is first built on top of a store of value. And only once you have that store of value, then you build on top of that another layer, which is the medium of exchange, and you can't expect a medium of exchange to be built on top of something that has no store of value. And the reason for that is Gresham's law, which we just covered, where basically the population tends to spend the lower value currency and only keep the higher value currency. And so the store of value accrues value over time, whereas the non-store of value currency just gets deprecated and spent over time. And without the store of value property, there's no reason for someone to hold it, and therefore no reason for it to become a medium of exchange over a long time period. And the case that Lynn puts together is built on comparing to other medium of exchange proof of work blockchains like Litecoin and Dogecoin and Bitcoin Cash, and showing that they pivoted to become a medium of exchange before they really proved out the store value use case, and therefore they failed. So that's kind of the main thrust of the thesis. And of course, in part two, the case will be made that once you have store value, then you build another layer on top of it. You don't have the core layer of the network being also the store of value and also the medium of exchange, because there's an inherent contradiction there. You can't have store of value without decentralization. You can't have medium of exchange without higher network requirements, which leads to centralization. Now, there were a few points here that I thought were interesting, worth commenting on. In general, I really agree with most of Lynn's points here, and I think this is just a fascinating read into kind of the history of money, the history of medium of exchanges, and what makes money money. That's a topic that I find really, really interesting, and I recommend reading her much longer in-depth piece, which is What is Money Anyway? But what's interesting to me is, A, there is just no discussion whatsoever in this piece on proof of stake, and I found it a little bit problematic in the beginning when she is comparing the different proof of work chains and how they've dropped out of the top 10 cryptocurrency and their market caps have dropped relative. Well, that's clear because today, if you look at the top 10 cryptocurrencies by market cap, most of those are proof of stake blockchains, right? We've got Ethereum in second place. Then you have stablecoins, USDT, USDC, Binance Smart Chain, Cardano, Ripple, BUSD, which is another stablecoin, Solana, and Polkadot. Only number 11 is Doge. And then afterwards, again, you have a bunch of proof of stake coins. And so the entire ecosystem, the entire industry has shifted away from proof of work. And Bitcoin is kind of the last proof of work standing. And that makes sense because in proof of work, there really is a zero sum game where the hash power can be used to attack other chains. And so you really, it's like a shelling point of hash power. The more hash power you have around one network, the more secure it is, the more you want to spend your hash power on that network. And so that's really kind of an economies of scale, a flywheel effect that Bitcoin has. Whereas in proof of stake, that's not quite the case. Dollars can be spent on any coin, and those coins can be staked. It's much easier to get into. It's much easier to get a network up. Some people will say that's a fault, which is why Bitcoin is so secure, and that's part of its defensibility. And some people will say that that is a plus side, a positive, because, well, you have better competition for Bitcoin, and you have the ability to avoid that centralization that Bitcoin miners represents because you can compete, because the market is more flat, it's more accessible to everyone. And so I found it interesting that there is no reference whatsoever to the proof of stake ecosystem whatsoever in the sense of going after the also the store of value and also the medium of exchange. Because at the end of the day, the case for Bitcoin and Lightning is a modular blockchain in many ways. And that is something that from the Ethereum ecosystem, we know very well and by now hold dear to our hearts. Ethereum is going for a modular design. They're not the only blockchain. Celestia is a modular blockchain. So this concept of having a base layer that is hard money, that is ultrasound money in ETH parlance terms, and then on top of that, building the medium of exchange is not foreign. And so it was interesting that Lynn Alden completely disregards it. Now, I think I know why, and that's because she's written a few other articles that critique Ethereum in the sense of its lack of decentralization relative to Bitcoin. I think we've even done a read-through of that early on in the podcast, where stablecoins are one vector of centralization. But in general, I think Lynn Alden thinks that Ethereum is less centralized, is less decentralized than Bitcoin, and that's one problem. Number two is that its monetary policy is less set in stone and it's less immutable. Ethereum has gone through different hard forks. They're about to go through a huge hard fork now with the shift to proof of stake, and that will also change the issuance and the monetary supply. And so the immutability is a feature for Bitcoin and not a bug. What's interesting, or kind of the main hole in this entire argument for me, and I think I'm going to go into this much deeper after the next read-through when we get to Lightning, is just a store of value for the long term requires a security budget. And to my mind and to my analysis, Bitcoin here falls far short of Ethereum in terms of a long-term security budget because the block rewards are shifting asymptotically towards zero. So we have less of a budget for security. And if transactions don't pick up really, really, really fast, and I will get into this after the second read-through, there will be no security budget that justifies a very high Bitcoin market cap. And this is an area where Ethereum really does shine. So there are trade-offs here, but I did find it interesting that the analysis doesn't discuss whatsoever proof-of-stake chains and Ethereum in general, which is considered the second largest store of value in the crypto ecosystem. And if we did compare gold to silver, you know, a lot of people compare Ethereum to oil. So that was interesting. But in general, I think the other main point that I wanted to touch on is basically Gresham's Law, which
historically makes a lot of sense when there is a large opportunity cost to holding one kind of cash. And that's because there historically was a large transaction cost to holding cash, whether it was physically in your house or whether it was in your bank account. Think about the transaction cost you used to have 10 years ago when you went overseas, and you would have to kind of go to the bank, exchange for a foreign currency, have that money stashed in your backpack. And then when you came home, there was nowhere you could use it because no one in your home country, in my home country, no one accepted, you know, this was before the euro, so no one accepted, you know, francs or Swiss francs or the pound or whatever it is. I mean, in general, people do, but you get my point. There was a transaction cost. There was a real opportunity cost to holding alternative forms of money. And that led to the main incentive to hold one form of money, the dominant form of money, which was historically gold. But in each era, there was a different kind of global power, right? Back in Roman times, you held the Roman dinar. When the British Empire ruled the seas, you held a pound. Today, you hold the dollar, because that is accepted in the most regions of the world. And so there is a tendency towards one central currency. I think that this is no longer the case. I think that this mindset, this fact, while being historically true, is less and less true going forward, because the transaction cost of holding different kinds of money is approaching zero. Today, in my bank account, I can hold pounds, dollars, euros, yuan, yen, all of these different currencies. And there's really no opportunity cost for me to hold it, because if I ever need to pay in that currency, then my credit card can just tap into it naturally. I can define that with my bank. If I'm going overseas, I can tap into them. If I'm back home, I can hold them. And there's no physical cost. The transaction costs are very low. And there's no real reason for me not to hold these alternative kinds of currencies. There's also the aspect of kind of diversification on Forex and things like that, which is more of a financial mental model to use. But also just in terms of me as a person, if I'm going overseas and I purchased euro, I come home, I don't necessarily want to trade it back into dollars, because I know that it's not a big deal. And I can use them whenever I want, and I can convert them whenever I want. There isn't the same transaction cost. Sure, I have to pay a 1.5% or 2% fee to Visa, MasterCard, my bank, whatever it is. But the point remains the same. The opportunity cost to holding different currencies is much lower today than it was in the past. And therefore, our incentives to trade back into the dominant currency is lower than it used to be, because we're not as concerned. And what that means is that the dominant currency has to offer more value than it used to. And Bitcoin does that because of its upward volatility, because of these huge upward spikes, so that it definitely does have that playing for it. But there is an argument in the Bitcoin camp that only one currency will win. And I just don't think that's the case. Because if you have utility from all kinds of altcoins or tokens, and it's a utility that only that coin can give you, well, it makes sense to hold it and to stake it if that's what it requires, or to buy it when you need it. And wallets are more and more, I mean, crypto wallets are offering this usability, this utility in the back end. And if you think about this as kind of airplane miles or Starbucks rewards points, today you have to hold those points because you're locked into that ecosystem. And if you could trade out of them, you might be incentivized to just dump them on the market. But at some point, if there is a market for those coins, there's a point of equilibrium where the supply and demand meet. And at that point, the value for that coin becomes real, because every day there are people who want to buy a Starbucks coffee. And if the value of those Starbucks rewards points would drop to a certain amount, there would be a real buyer's market for them. And so as long as there is real utility to coins, the fact that, you know, Bitcoin or the dollar become the dominant currency at a at a point in history where there is very low transaction costs and very low opportunity cost to trading into those coins, I think that the Gresham's Law, the dominant money theory, just doesn't hold up. Now, that might have been a little bit confused. I hope it was clear enough. Those kind of two points that I wanted to make about the first part of the article, where one, disregarding proof of stake is slightly strange for me, and two, I'm not as bought into the future of Gresham's Law as a lot of the Bitcoin camp is, but the core thesis here remains the same, and it's really well put together here, it's well reasoned out, and that is that a medium of exchange is built first on top of a store of value. And store of value comes from being decentralized, from having that immutable monetary system, or at least a system that you know and you can rely on, and having the auditability of being able to run your own node. That's why decentralization is so critical for a store of value. Built on top of that, you start building the medium of exchange. And that's where a lot of the other proof of work altcoins failed. So with that little summary, I'm going to call today's episode a wrap, clocking in here at just a little bit over an hour. And next week, we're going to pick up and dive in with the volatile process of monetization and the Lightning Network.